This Janet Mefford Today podcast is sponsored by Heart for Lebanon, the Christian ministry working among 2 million Syrian refugee families who've been displaced. For just $29 a month, you can help Heart for Lebanon reach out in Jesus' name to a family of six, providing them with food, Christian education, survival essentials, and the gospel. Please call now, 888-247-5499. That's 888-247-5499 or janetmefford.com.
This is Janet Mefford Today.
Our confidence is in Christ alone.
Are we going to stand with God, come what may?
If the Word of God says it, I believe it.
And that's the way it is.
And now, here is Janet Mefford.
Hey, everybody. Great to have you with us again. I have to say, I'm not at all surprised at the antics of the New York Times. Did you see this? It wasn't just in the pages of the New York Times, but also on Twitter, that the New York Times had the audacity to say that airplanes took aim at the World Trade Center on 9/11. Airplanes, really? American Airlines and United Airlines just turned on the automatic pilot, set it for the World Trade Center Towers 1 and 2, Shanksville, Pennsylvania, the Pentagon. And boy, those evil airplanes just took aim at those buildings and those sites in the United States, and havoc was wreaked. Are you kidding me? This is the tweet. I'm reading the tweet before they deleted it. And I'm thankful that enough Americans would give them a hard time that they would feel shamed into deleting it. This is how the New York Times thinks, though. It said 18 years have passed since airplanes took aim and brought down the World Trade Center. Today, families will once again gather and grieve at the site where more than 2,000 people died. No, actually, it was almost 3,000. How about you stop minimizing how many people were murdered in cold blood by Islamic terrorists as airplanes took aim? They also said it in the pages of their newspaper. 18 years have passed since airplanes took aim at the World Trade Center and brought them down. And I said, rather tongue-in-cheek, this is brought to you by the same media that told us that a truck attacked a crowd in Nice, France. You remember that? I said it's like that old Stephen King story, a book, when it talks about wayward trucks that just go nuts, machines that go nuts and start attacking people. There's nobody behind the wheel, huh? Nobody actually hijacked those planes and murdered Americans in cold blood. It was those airplanes, those darn airplanes. Come off it. You know, but this is what we have to go through with subsequent 9/11s. Every time we have a 9/11, we have to look to see what's the left going to do this year. Well, that's not even the worst of what went on yesterday. I have to talk about this as well, because this was getting a lot of press and it is concerning. There is a church in Bloomfield Hills, Michigan. It's called Bloomfield Hills Baptist Church. And they were all set to hold a 2-day event taking place both yesterday and today, asking some very important questions about whether or not 9/11 has been forgotten. And even maybe more importantly, is Michigan surrendering to Islam? Keep in mind, Bloomfield Hills, folks, is the same congressional district that is served by Muslim lawmaker Rashida Tlaib. Just keep that in mind. Keep this in mind as I unveil this whole story to you. I want to go and talk about what actually was put out in the news a few days before this event so I can kind of timeline it for you. The bottom line is they ended up canceling this. Now, let's go back to Fox 2 Detroit, because as soon as it came out that they would be holding this event, featuring, by the way, an ex-Muslim who's now a Christian, and also our friend Jim Simpson, who we featured on the show many, many times, who is really an expert on the Red-Green Axis, the Marxist and the Islamist Alliance to try to bring down the United States. And this is how Fox 2 Detroit reported on this just a few days ago. This is cut one.
Now, the Bloomfield Hills Baptist Church behind me off Telegraph is providing a place for those events to happen on 9/11. Now, they're actually being hosted and organized by the Detroit Coalition for Freedom. Now, that group, they say their mission, according to their website, is to promote and preserve American values. Now, the head minister here, Donald McKay, supports that group and its teachings. And tonight, he's defending the church's decision to have that event right here.
Islam is a growing threat in the United States of America.
It's on the flyer and straight from the head minister at Bloomfield Hills Baptist Church that will host an event stirring controversy.
We do not hate Muslims. We hate the ideology that they are identified with.
Pastor Dr. Donald McKay says he's speaking for himself, not the church, where the events happened September 11th and 12th.
Jessica, I am an Islamophobe. I wear that badge proudly.
McKay explains the theme of the discussion organized by the Metropolitan Detroit Freedom Coalition.
We believe that Muslims, committed Muslims, Muslims who are familiar with their faith, are committed really to the overthrow of the United States and to world domination.
Well, what's really interesting when you watch that report and you watch the video of that report is how many times you can see them just cut the pastor off, where if they had allowed him to speak a little bit longer, he would have explained things more. They'll take out their, I'm an Islamophobe. What he's trying to say, obviously, is we do have reason to fear an ideology that is determined to destroy our civilization from within, like the Muslim Brotherhood, or through violent acts of terror like Al-Qaeda. How do you deny this? How much more information do we need to provide to people to understand that there is a threat and he's not making it up? Remember what happened 18 years ago yesterday? So this is the rest of the story when the Detroit lawmakers, these Michigan lawmakers, who Democrats, of course, and Hamas-linked CARE got involved. Listen to cut two.
Some local lawmakers condemning the event and the church for hosting. Congresswoman Debbie Dingell and Congressman Andy Levin releasing this joint statement calling it an anti-Muslim gathering, adding there is no place for hate in Metro Detroit. They are imploring the church to cancel. State Representatives Hamoud and Manoogian releasing a statement to fellow House Democrats bringing attention to the event they say is an attempt to blame the 9/11 attacks on the entire Muslim population. Pastor McKay says they have it wrong.
You know, the tone of the meetings that we're going to be having is not aggressive. It's not, oh, we hate these people.
He's extending an offer to discuss his position with lawmakers speaking out.
If Dingell would like to sit down, have lunch with me, I'll even buy.
Well, there went that, because they canceled the event in favor of a webinar instead. And I'm looking at the brochure for the event. 9/11 Forgotten is Michigan Surrendering to Islam. Two-day event, vital briefings, how the interfaith movement is sabotaging America and the church, presented by Sharam Hadian, Christian pastor, former Muslim, and former law enforcement. That was to have taken place yesterday. And then Jim Simpson's presentation on how Islam is destroying America from within. And they're in trouble? The Christians are in trouble? Oh, yeah. When I went to their website, they took everything down. They just had a static page there saying, we canceled our event. Well, I can only imagine what's going on for these people behind the scenes. And before people get all worked up and say, this church has no courage and what are they doing? Why don't they, you know, stand firm? You don't know what might have happened to that church behind the scenes, folks. You have no idea. And neither do I. It hasn't come out in great detail what the reasons were for that church canceling. It does say via WND that CARE, the Council on American Islamic Relations, the unindicted co-conspirator in the Hamas Holy Land Foundation funding trial, along with members of Congress and state representatives, pressed the church to cancel the event and its elders complied. The executive director of CARE's Michigan chapter, named Dawood Waleed, cast the event's message as anti-Muslim bigotry. Aren't you sick of this? I am. Well, Lee told the Detroit Free Press, though we believe that houses of worship have the right to preach their doctrine, we find it incredibly irresponsible for a church to invite someone who has the objective of spewing clear anti-Muslim bigotry. Oh, by the way, let's talk about CARE and the designation as a terrorist organization in the United Arab Emirates. Should we talk about that a little bit? Should we talk about the Muslim Brotherhood? Should we talk about Hamas terror funding trial? Should we talk about all that stuff with CARE? Moderate Muslims. No, they're a bunch of agitators. This is the United States of America. Christianity was here first. We have freedom of religion for everybody. But if a church wants to talk about the truth on Islam, they should be able to do it and they shouldn't be pressured. I understand why CARE would pressure them, because they have a vested interest in shutting down truth. Why in the world are American politicians pressuring a Christian church to shut down an event, other than the fact that they are terrified of Muslim reaction? That's what it's about. Why don't you stand up for the freedom of Christian Americans to tell the truth about the very ideology that got almost 3,000 Americans killed 18 years ago yesterday? That's my thing. And it shouldn't just be one church that is holding these sorts of events, in my opinion. I think lots of churches across the country ought to be doing similar things because there's strength in numbers. Now, when we come back, I want to get into why, when the pastor says that Islam is a threat to the United States, he's exactly right. We'll come back. Listening to Janet Mefford today. Stay with us. There's been a leftist takeover within conservative Christianity. Ungodly socialist ideas are coming to prominence. Ideas like social justice, critical race theory, and cultural Marxism. And leading figures within mainstream evangelicalism are showing themselves to be untrustworthy as shepherds and guardians of the truth. If you're a Christian who wants to know what to do about this serious shift away from biblical truth, then I invite you to join me at the upcoming Stand Against Marxism conference, taking place October 18th and 19th. In Des Moines, Iowa. Hosted by the Enemies Within the Church Project, the Stand Against Marxism conference will inform you about this dangerous infiltration of postmodern thought, connect you with other concerned Christians, and teach you how to defend biblical Christianity in your own church. Register now for the Stand Against Marxism conference, October 18th and 19th in Des Moines, Iowa. For more information, you can visit standagainstmarxism.com. That's standagainstmarxism.com. See you there.
When I heard her heartbeat, I decided to keep her. And now my daughter's about to be 3. I don't know where my life would be without her.
The Ministry of Preborn invites you to share your pro-life message through sharing heartbeats. You see, when a young woman considering abortion sees her baby on ultrasound and hears the heartbeat, 8 out of 10 times, she'll choose life for her preborn baby.
That ultrasound changed everything for me. It really did. That made it all worthwhile to know that I was going to have a little blessing. And when she got here, it was just, oh my gosh.
Preborn is the largest provider of free ultrasounds in the country. Would you join with Preborn and Janet Mefford today? For $140, you can sponsor 5 ultrasounds and help save 5 babies' lives. All gifts are tax deductible, and 100% of your donation goes toward saving babies' lives. Call now, 855-402-2229, 855-402-BABY. That's 855-402-BABY, or there's a banner to click at janetmefford.com. Welcome back to Janet Mefford today. Bloomfield Hills, Michigan is under siege, I guess, from the Muslim lawmaker Rashida Tlaib's friends. I'm not saying she got involved in this personally necessarily, but we did have a backlash against this church, Bloomfield Hills Baptist Church. They were to hold a 2-day 9/11 event beginning yesterday and going on into today, and really getting into whether or not 9/11 has been forgotten and whether or not the interfaith movement is destroying the church and how we are really facing some very dangerous days in the United States as Islam has designs on destroying the United States from within. That's the stated goal of the Muslim Brotherhood, folks. This isn't being, you know, torn out of a hat somewhere. But again, this church ended up canceling the event. They were pressured by CARE. Might I add that CARE not only is an unindicted co-conspirator in the Hamas funding trial, but the United Arab Emirates, as I mentioned before, it was about 5 years ago, 2014, listed CARE as one of 83 banned terrorist organizations, along with the Taliban, Al-Qaeda, and ISIS. You think they know something about Islam in the United Arab Emirates that we don't? Apparently so. Apparently so. But in the United States, particularly, it would seem in Michigan, CARE just gets carte blanche to shut down events that they don't like because you dare not say anything that CARE doesn't like. You know, this church, I don't know all the details about why they shut it down, but we got to stop being scared. You know, what is the alternative? That's what I want to ask people. If you don't tell the truth about what's going on, what do you think will happen? Do you think it will be a better result than if you did speak out? I just don't see the logic in all of that. And I salute them for doing what they wanted to do. But it's getting harder and harder for Christian organizations to do anything that either the Islamic community or the LGBT community doesn't like. And it's through these tactics, pressure and shaming and spewing around insults and accusing them of bigotry and hatred. There's hatred has no home here. That is the dumbest line. I don't like hate either. We're not to hate anybody as Christians. We are to love our enemies and to pray for those who persecute us. But it's such a self-righteous thing, and it's such a loaded thing. They're always using it in the context of shutting down free speech, criticizing what is rightly to be criticized, whether it's homosexuality or the Muslim Brotherhood or what have you. So pray for this church. Like I said, I don't know all the details about why they shut it down, but it's disgraceful that they were forced to. It was disgraceful that these media organizations made them out to be some kind of crazies. It's ridiculous. Now, I go back to a piece that Annie McCarthy wrote back in 2010. Now, Annie McCarthy, I've interviewed him many, many times over the years. He's the former federal prosecutor in the 1993 World Trade Center bombing case, Put Away the Blind Sheikh. And he writes for National Review Online and has written a number of great books. And he has written some unbelievably great stuff on the Muslim Brotherhood. One of the things that he said in this piece for the New York Post is this. He said, most Americans don't realize that jihad is about much more than terrorism. Even the terrorists don't blow up buildings for the sake of blowing up buildings. There's method in their madness. Jihad is not mindless mass murder, nor is it a syrupy internal struggle to become a better person. No, jihad is the mission to establish and spread Sharia. The installation of Allah's law, believed by Muslims to be a divine injunction, is the necessary precondition to the creation of Islamic societies. While it can and often is waged forcibly, Islamists don't resort to violence, or at least to more violence, where surrenders, appeasements, and capitulations are available. And Al-Qaeda is merely an offshoot of the central Islamist group, the Muslim Brotherhood. Founded in 1928, the Ikhwan's motto to this day remains, Allah is our objective, the Prophet is our leader, the Quran is our law, jihad is our way, dying in the way of Allah is our highest hope. In 1991, Muhammad Akram, a U.S.-based chieftain of the Brotherhood, penned a memo for the eyes of the central leadership in Egypt. Later seized by the FBI, this self-described explanatory memorandum on the general strategic goal for the group in North America outlined the game plan for what the organization regards as its civilizational war against the West. The Ikhwan must understand that their work in America is a kind of grand jihad in eliminating and destroying the Western civilization from within and sabotaging its miserable house by their hands and the hands of the believers so that it is eliminated and God's religion is made victorious over all other religions. That's in the memo. That's a quote. Nor was there anything new about this grand jihad. During a post 9/11 raid, Swiss authorities found a similar smoking gun, a methodical plan for the long-term cultural invasion of the West that was written by Brotherhood terrorists, theorists, perhaps you want to call them, in 1982. 1982. Wow, do you think that Western Europe has had a cultural invasion? As a matter of fact, this sabotage strategy has been in place for nearly half a century. Its bottom-up elements stress Islamist domination of Muslim education, mosques, and community centers. From these bases of operation in every city, the Brotherhood's method is not terrorize, but to slipstream behind Islamist terrorists, assuming the posture of moderates. The goal is to seep Sharia, Islam's totalitarian legal code that governs not just the spiritual realm, but all aspects of life, into our politics, our law, our financial system, our educational institutions, our labor negotiations, our familial relations, and all facets of our domestic and foreign policy, from healthcare to engagement with Iran. Yes, all these years after the Iranian Revolution, 17 years at the time, after Islamists declared war on the U.S. by bombing the World Trade Center, and 9 years, now 18 years after the 9/11 atrocities, the American people are still in the dark about the daunting challenge we face. Under jihadist siege for decades, we still don't even get what jihad is and why it isn't just about violent extremists, the politically correct term now used by government officials in their desperation to bleach the Islam out of Islamist terror. He mentions that he wrote about this ethos of conscious avoidance and willful blindness. Great book, by the way. But that was a memoir about trying to confront international terrorism as a federal prosecutor in the 90s. The forces arrayed against us are much more extensive and insidious than Al-Qaeda. And they're not just pressing the limitations of our criminal justice system. The game plan being executed against us targets American constitutional democracy itself, taking aim at its core principles of individual liberty. lavishly backed by Saudi billions, thanks to a decades-old partnership with the kingdom, the Brotherhood is now raising in our midst. And keep in mind, this was 9 years ago he wrote this. It's third generation of operatives and sympathizers. Its tentacles include such high-profile organizations as CARE, the Council on American Islamic Relations, the Islamic Society of North America. Oh, yes, ISNA. That's where Bernie Sanders recently spoke, along with Julian Castro. And the Muslim American Society, which is the Brotherhood's semi-official American branch. Keep in mind, folks, civilizational jihad is their goal. We're going to infiltrate from within. Why do something violent when we can do it other ways? We can get appeasement. We can scare people. We can intimidate people. We can call people Islamophobes. They love calling people Islamophobes. That's what the Muslim Brotherhood is all about. You need to feel bad. You need to feel bad. How in the world can we look at 9/11 from 18 years hence and conclude that they're the victims? Nobody ever said that every single Muslim in the world was responsible for 9/11. What people said again and again and again was, who will condemn this among the Muslim population? Who will speak out? Who will help? Who will talk about this horrible, horrible terrorist attack and will decry this? You know, there weren't a lot of voices, were there? And now everything is turned around. Everything is turned around. We're the problem. Americans are the problem because they're anti-Muslim bigots. They're Islamophobes. They're terrible. Hate has no home here. It's a war of rhetoric, folks. And we're losing it. That's what I fear. We're losing. We're losing because you lose every war that you will not fight. And how in the world will people fight a war, a cultural war, albeit a cultural war, not a physical war? Why would you fight or how would you fight if you don't know what's going on? That's why these sorts of events that take place at places like Bloomfield Hills Baptist Church have to be intimidated into shutting down. The question is, what does the Christian church do about this? What do we as Bible-believing Christians do about this? Don't we have some sort of a responsibility as Christians to tell the truth when the rest of the culture will not? Even though there are people who are not Christians who certainly understand the threat and talk about it. Shutting down free speech, shutting down freedom of assembly, shutting down any sort of idea that people have that they want to inform their fellow citizens and their fellow patriots that our country is under threat. This is extremely serious stuff, and I don't see it getting any better unless we really start recognizing what is being done to us. What the Global Islamist Project is doing, as Andy McCarthy said 9 years ago, and how were the subjects of his book, The Grand Jihad, which is just fantastic. That's an incredible book. The story of the ideology that not only fuels anti-American terror, but stokes a seditious jihadist campaign to Islamize our society. That's what's going on. That's what's going on, and we need to know about it. And we need to pray for this church, and we need to pray for every Christian and every Islamic expert like our friend Jim Simpson, who's willing to tell the truth. It's just so important. And I'm very grateful for those truth tellers because it's getting harder and harder and harder to tell the truth without some pushback and without some consequence. It should not be that way in the United States of America. It will only get worse if we don't fight to preserve the nation that God has given to us. By the way, this helps me segue into what I want to tell you, which is we want to see you at our upcoming Stand Against Marxism conference. This is going to be such a great gathering, folks. I'm going to be speaking. A host of other people are going to be speaking at this. We've been talking about the problem of social justice and Marxism within our society, but it's also infiltrating our evangelical churches, our seminaries, our denominations. We're exposing it. We're exposing it. This is hosted by the Enemies Within the Church Project, and it's going to be fantastic. It will be October 18th and 19th in Des Moines, Iowa, and we're going to get into all of these socialist ideas that are coming to prominence, things like social justice, critical race theory, cultural Marxism, you name it, we're going to talk about it. And I'm going to be talking at the fundraiser banquet on the subject of a different gospel, why Christians must fight social justice. I would love to meet you. There's more information at StandAgainstMarxism.com. StandAgainstMarxism.com. October 18th and 19th in Des Moines, Iowa, the Stand Against Marxism Conference. I can't wait, and I can't wait to see you there. We're going to come back on Janet Mefford today. Stay with us.
This Janet Mefford Today podcast is sponsored by Heart for Lebanon, the Christian ministry working among 2 million Syrian refugee families who've been displaced. For just $29 a month, you can help Heart for Lebanon reach out in Jesus' name to a family of six, providing them with food, Christian education, survival essentials, and the gospel. Please call now, 888-247-5499. That's 888-247-5499 or janetmefford.com. Welcome back to Janet Mefford Today. Well, as the radical pro-abortion lobby grows ever more desperate to preserve abortion on demand, pro-lifers are stepping up to honor its victims. On Saturday, pro-life Americans will be gathering across the country to mourn abortion's unborn victims during the 7th annual National Day of Remembrance for Aborted Children. And we're going to find out more about it now from Eric Scheidler, Executive Director of the Pro-Life Action League. Eric, great to have you with us. Thank you so much for being here.
It's always great to talk to you, Janet.
Yeah, tell us a little bit. I know this is the 7th year, as I had mentioned, for the National Day of Remembrance. Tell us a little bit about how it got started and why you think this is just such an important thing to do.
Well, the whole event got started in 2013 when we were realizing that a very important anniversary is coming up. Back in 1988, a whole series of burials had taken place in Milwaukee and Chicago and several other locations around the country where some abortion victims, little unborn babies, whose bodies had been recovered by pro-life activists from a pathology lab loading dock in the Chicago suburbs. These babies were sitting out on this loading dock, and one of the employees of this pathology lab was really troubled that all these corpses of aborted babies, here's a pro-life guy, were sitting on this loading dock just, you know, in the elements. And he contacted a pregnancy resource center, and one thing led to another, and pro-life activists came one night and recovered these bodies from all these boxes and discovered that they were all marked with where they had been aborted. And so as much as possible, the bodies were attempted to be returned to pro-lifers in those towns who could provide a burial for them. And it took a tremendous amount of work and negotiations. And in fact, in one case, some aborted body remains, some fetal remains that had been recovered from a dumpster in Chicago, the abortion facility actually sued my organization, the Pro-Life Action League, claiming that we had stolen their property by going into the dumpster behind the building to recover these victims' bodies and give them a proper burial. So, you know, all of this was taking place in the 80s. 88 was a very important year for numerous burials taking place. And so we decided it was a time to recognize this anniversary, the 25th anniversary of this, you know, act of mercy for these children. This expression of our belief that they are God's children and they deserve to be treated that way, even in death. So these burials were arranged, and then we had this wonderful experience of inviting people to come out, not just to the grave sites of aborted babies around the country, which at the time we knew about 24 of them, and we've doubled that number. We've discovered so many more of these stories of these types of burials. There's over 50 of them now around the country. But not only do we go to those locations, but also to other memorial markers set up by the hundreds all over the country to remember these children. It was such a moving experience the first year we did it. So many people felt, especially those who've been involved with abortion, felt a sense of healing. For many, it was their first steps down the journey of repentance and recovery and healing for the abortions in their lives, that we decided this has to become an annual event. So every year on the second Saturday of September, we go out again to these memorial markers and these burial places, and we pray and we mourn, and we remember our Lord's promise that when we mourn, we will be blessed.
Right. It's just so heartbreaking to that. Not only what you said about Planned Parenthood being upset that not upset that there were actual babies in dumpsters, but upset that you would give them humanity and you would recognize their humanity. That just blows my mind.
And we're still fighting those battles today. I mean, just a few days ago, there was a hearing in federal court over a Texas law that would require fetal remains that is to say, the bodies of our precious unborn brothers and sisters, after abortion, fetal remains to be properly buried or cremated, and the abortion industry is fighting tooth and claw to stop that from happening. Somehow they've decided that it's not enough to kill these children. We also have to discard their bodies like garbage, put them in incinerators and flush them down the drain and even throw them in dumpsters in many cases. So we're still fighting this battle today, and it's critical that we use every means that we can to humanize these children who have been so dehumanized and demonized even by our society. You know, the unborn child is a kind of an enemy. The fetus is used as a term of disparagement. Yeah. These are human beings, precious human beings at an important stage of life. And we go out there and we mourn for them. And I got to say, standing over the grave, the place where I'll be out on Saturday, the 14th of September, 2033, little tiny unborn babies' bodies are buried in this gravesite. And standing there and thinking about, you know, it's 30 years later now. These have been adults. Some of them would be parents now. Mm-hmm. The whole generations that have been cut off by this act of violence. It really brings it home when you stand at those gravesites, when you go to those other memorial markers that I like to think of as being spiritually linked to those burial places. And of course, you know, all of the landfills and the incinerators that have become the sort of resting place, in a sense, of these children. They're all united on this day of remembrance.
Right. Well, now, I know this will be taking place at a number of sites. Where all will people be? How widespread will this National Day of Remembrance be?
Well, we have over 180 locations. We may even be up to 190 or 200 at this point. The event keeps growing every year, all over the country. I don't know if we're in all 50 states, but we may well be at this point. So there's a very good chance that your listeners will find a memorial service taking place near them. You can find all of those at nationaldayofremembrance.com. That's nationaldayofremembrance.com. And in many cases, there are stories accompanying the information about the memorial services, stories of how the bodies were recovered, how they were buried, how they've been remembered over the years. So there's a lot of interesting and very moving and even heartbreaking stories to be read there.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. And I'm curious, because when you mentioned that these burials continue starting in 1988, as you talked about earlier, how do you tend to obtain the bodies of these children or the remains of these children in order to give them a proper burial? What have been some of the ways that you've been able to get those children in hand so you really can give them a dignified burial?
Well, back in the 1980s, very often, abortion facilities were simply dumping these bodies in dumpsters in behind their abortion facilities, you know, alleyways in Chicago where you could go and dumpster dive and recover these bodies, and pro-lifers were doing that. The abortion issue got savvy, though, and started to find ways of keeping us from being able to get to those children's bodies and properly not just bury them, but also record what we can of the abortion experience. The victim photos that you've seen out there that are on websites and sometimes out in the public square and on flyers that have changed so many people's hearts on abortion were, by and large, recovered are the photographs of the taken by the pro-lifers who did this recovery of their bodies and accomplished these burials. Mm-hmm. These days, once in a while, you'll find an abortionist foolish enough to leave these bodies in a dumpster. Just a couple of years ago, in Michigan, an abortionist named Dr. Hodari was found to have been doing this, and so there was a fairly recent burial in the Detroit area just last year of some more of those bodies. One of the more interesting cases historically is the victims of Kermit Gosnell, the House of Horrors abortionist in Philadelphia, who is now in prison for murdering children who survived his botched abortions. Their bodies were kind of quietly buried by the authorities in Philadelphia. Pro-lifers tried to get access to the bodies, and in order to provide that, you know, maybe a funeral and a burial for them. But eventually we discovered where they had been quietly buried, and now a memorial service is held there every year. And there's a wonderful couple that's working to erect a memorial stone there that will tell the visitors exactly what happened there. So, You know, every burial place has its own story. And there are some beautiful stories behind some of those memorial markers, too. You know, the inspiration for them, you know, why they were put up at various churches and cemeteries around the country.
Right. Oh, I'm so glad. I did not realize until you just said that, that you were able to find out. Pro-lifers are so good at getting to the bottom of information when they want it. I mean, that's the wonderful thing about our movement, but that you were able to find out where those Gosnell babies were buried. And that's, you know, it does give a sense of closure, but it also points out how much more work there is to do when we look at the unbelievable numbers of children who have been slaughtered for no reason, 60 million plus in this country. I want to get into a little bit more with Eric Scheidler when we come back about the state of abortion in America right now. There's a lot to talk about. Stay with us. We'll be back on Janet Mefford Today. Hi, this is Janet Mefford. Let me tell you about Gofran and Khalid. They're refugee brothers who were orphaned during the Syrian war, and now they live in a tent in a farmer's field in Lebanon. It's a sad situation. But every other week when Heart for Lebanon's Hope on Wheels educational fun truck shows up, they're usually right on the front row singing worship songs and reciting Bible verses. In the middle of despair, Gofran and Khalid are finding hope in Jesus. But this only happens as you give. $29 a month will help bring Christian education, food, and survival assistance essentials to boys like this and their families. Call 888-247-5499. That's 888-247-5499, or there's a banner to click at janetmefford.com. For just 98 cents a day, you can help a refugee family of six for an entire year through the great work that Heart for Lebanon does every single day. Please call now, 888-247-5499, 888-247-5499, or janetmefford.com. Are you among the millions of Americans who feel uncertain when it comes to your health care? As a Christian, are you looking for health care that doesn't violate your morals and convictions? Well, we're happy to inform you that there is a solution, and that solution is Liberty HealthShare. Liberty HealthShare is a community of like-minded Christians who work together to pay for their medical costs. It allows you to decide how, when, and where you will access health care so you can make the best choice for you and your family. Starting at $199 a month for a single, up to $529 a month for a family. That's mom, dad, and all the kids. This is how healthcare should be. For more information, call 855-585-4237 or visit lightyourliberty.com. That's lightyourliberty.com, and regain control over your healthcare costs. 855-585-4237 or lightyourliberty.com. Together, we're changing healthcare for good. Welcome back to Janet Mefford Today. It's good to have you with us, and also good to be talking with Eric Scheidler, Executive Director of the Pro-Life Action League, and he is here to fill us in on what will be going on Saturday, September 14th, during the National Day of Remembrance for Aborted Children. This is the seventh annual remembrance of these precious ones who are not forgotten by God and not forgotten by us, and we're talking about the importance of giving these children a dignified burial and remembering their lives. This is such a critical thing. You know, one of the things, Eric, that comes to mind when you were talking about what was going on in Texas and what's been happening with the pro-aborts trying to just get in the way of every pro-life law that we are able to pass at the state level, especially. The Supreme Court, as everybody knows, upheld Indiana's law not too long ago. I think it was May, requiring abortionists to bury or cremate fetal remains. What kind of effect do you see this potentially having on giving aborted children proper burials across the country in the future? Do you think this will really help more states and give them an impetus to go forward and pass laws just like Indiana's, so this can be a normal part of what we can give to these children?
Yes, I, you know, it is a controversial area because, you know, there are some in the pro-life movement who would suggest that, you know, requiring this kind of a cremation or proper burial is sort of condoning what's happened in the abortions. But I think we have to recognize it's the federal courts that have forced abortion on the states, and the states are trying to do everything they can, the pro-life states, to acknowledge the humanity of these children through waiting periods, through ultrasound laws, through measures like this that would require a proper burial. So I think this is an important acknowledgement of that humanity, and it really creates a contradiction. I mean, it says to people, look, we're saying it's okay to kill these children, but we also are saying, our laws are saying that they are human beings who deserve to die, because they are. They're yes. to be buried.
Right.
They are human beings, and that's a scientific fact, that's a philosophical fact, it's a spiritual fact, it's a human fact, and anything we can do to kind of create these contradictions and cognitive dissonance for the public and get them thinking is helpful. Not only that, though, but these kinds of laws could have an impact on abortion rates, because when you have these kinds of requirements, it can increase the cost of abortion, because incinerating a whole weekend's worth of aborted baby bodies is a lot cheaper than properly cremating or burying them.
Yeah.
And anytime abortion prices go up, abortion rates go down, because that decision is made on a knife's edge. A lot of times people are looking for any excuse. Someone just standing outside an abortion clinic with their Bible praying, or the price being a few bucks more than they thought it was going to be. That can save a life. So we want to do everything that we can. And I do think that we're going to see more and more of these types of laws passed, especially since the Supreme Court upheld that provision of the Indiana law. I was very encouraged to see that. That said, I've been trying to find out exactly what impact that's having on the abortion business in Indiana. I've made calls to some of the legislators involved in that, and I've talked to the Attorney General, and I'm trying to get to the bottom of, what's actually happening? How is this being enforced? And so there's still some question marks about implementing it, but that's always going to be the case with something that's so new and kind of creative.
Sure, of course. And I agree with you. I think creating the cognitive dissonance is a way of forcing their hand. Look at what you're doing, and telling the public, these are human beings, for crying out loud. Well, now, when we're talking about where you are in the state of Illinois, there's been a lot of attention, I know, this year, both to New York and to Illinois and other states as well. But especially those two, on the radical new abortion legislation that you have seen passed there. Can you talk about what is going on, what kinds of strategies you guys have employed or are thinking about employing to fight back against this evil? Because the pro-aborts, as they get more desperate, they get more radical, to the point where we have Ralph Northam in Virginia, the governor, keeping his job even after saying if a baby is born alive after a failed abortion, the mother can decide whether or not that child lives or dies. I mean, we're in really ghoulish times here.
It's horrifying, and it's particularly disturbing how much the media are in collaboration with the abortion industry and pro-abortion politicians in not being honest about what they're saying and the positions that they're taking. But they keep going to the extremes. I mean, just the other day, presidential candidate Pete Buttigieg of South Bend, a pro-abortion town in a very pro-life state, it talked about how life doesn't begin until breath. And the irony is, he was using the Bible to make that claim, ignoring all the beautiful things the Bible has to say about our being knit in the womb and God knowing us from the very first moment of our existence in the womb.
Right.
We're constantly accused of trying to force the Bible on people, and our position being based on religion is based on natural law, it's based on science, it's based on common sense and common humanity, on common law. And here we have someone, who would accuse us of Bible thumping, doing the exact same thing, but in favor of abortion and the destruction of innocent human life. So the extremism from the other side is incredibly disturbing. It's heartbreaking for someone like me who lives in what has now become the most pro-abortion state in the country, particularly galling since this is the land of Lincoln. One who championed the right to freedom for a whole class of human beings who were considered to not really be our brothers and sisters, the enslaved Africans in America. And so we're doing what we can to fight it on the ground. Going directly to the people with the truth about abortion becomes more urgent because the law is so against us. But we're also looking at legal challenges, especially in regards to conscience rights.
Good. Good.
People being forced to pay for abortion through insurance or, abortion being required as a service by medical practitioners in violation of their conscience. So there are some provisions of the law that are going to be challenged in court, but a lot of work needs to be done on the ground, especially at the abortion facilities, because that's really our only chance in many states to make a difference and to save children from abortion by being there ourselves.
Right, right. Well, another thing that's come up recently is that CEO of STEM Express, people will remember this, the undercover videos that were taken by pro-lifers David Dalyden and Sandra Merritt. And during this courtroom appearance, the CEO admitted on the stand that the company brokered beating fetal hearts and intact baby heads to medical researchers. I mean, talk about ghoulish. Now there's an admission there. People are seeing this in the news, but they're not really seeing it in the news, are they, Eric? Because it's the pro-lifers who are telling the truth about this, the pro-life websites, and all of us who care about these children, we're hearing about it. The mainstream media, though, doesn't seem to care. It goes back to your point that they're really in bed with the pro-abortion lobby, and people are really having the truth kept from them.
Yeah, it's been disturbing to see how little mainstream coverage there's been of that trial. And, you know, listeners might think this is a trial of STEM Express and Planned Parenthood. It's not. This
right.
is a trial of Dalyden and Merritt.
Yeah.
They're trying to get them on criminal charges for the undercover investigations that they did in the state of California. It's the only time in California history that undercover journalists like this, citizen journalists, have been charged with violating the law in this way. But yet that law has a provision for citizens to use that technology to discover crimes that are being committed. So we're hopeful that David and Sandra will be exonerated in that case. But there has been some mainstream coverage. It starts to leak out. And, you know, if there's finally a when there finally is a result in this case, especially if they are found not guilty, the mainstream media will have no choice but to cover it to some degree, and that becomes an opportunity for us.
Right.
We get out on the streets, we get out on social media, and we start to tell our story. It's getting harder and harder for them to keep the truth from the public.
Well, it is, and when I think of all the great work you and your father have done over the years, it must be, you know, we're still heartbroken that abortion on demand is legal in the United States. We're still not to the point where we can eradicate abortion. But how do you keep going? I mean, as you're doing some of the hardest work I think there is to do for anybody who cares about human life, what is it that just keeps you going, Eric, and your whole team there at Pro-Life Action League? Because I think that it is a tough job. It really is a tough job because your heart breaks every single day.
Well, you know, for me, a lot of it is the fact that I grew up with this. You know, I was 6 years old when I attended my first pro-life rally in 1972, before Roe versus Wade. I saw my dad give up a lucrative career in advertising to become a pro-life activist and become one of the founders of the pro-life activist movement in the United States. And so I've known this was going to be a long-term fight. So I try to take the long view and not expect silver bullets and easy wins and be, you know, we have to be able to take a hit like anybody who's fighting.
Right.
You take a hit, you have a loss from time to time, like we did here in Illinois. You celebrate your victories, like Planned Parenthood losing their Title X funding this year, which was in part a direct result of pro-lifers getting out in the streets and under the, you know, hashtag protest PP banner and calling for Planned Parenthood to be defunded. So you thank God for the victories. You ask him for his strength. You ask a lot of people to pray for you. I mean, that's really what it is. There's thousands of people that are praying for me and my staff here at the Pro-Life Action League and all those who are active in the movement in this way. And those prayers sustain us even when we don't feel particularly encouraged.
Yeah.
But you know, taking the long view and realizing that everything that we do for these children, especially when we're out there at the abortion facilities, if all we can do is to mourn for them, we do that, and that's a victory.
Well,
that's a victory against death. And so we celebrate that,
yep,
and we put our trust in God that he's going to mount those victories.
You got to do that. Well, check out nationaldayofremembrance.com on Saturday. The 7th annual National Day of Remembrance for Aborted Children will take place at 180-plus locations. So check it out, nationaldayofremembrance.com. Eric Scheidler with us from the Pro-Life Action League. Keep up the good work, Eric. It was great to have you here.
Will do.
Thank you so much. Thanks for being with us on Janet Mefford today. We'll see you next time.